Good evening. It's really nice to be back here. I don't know if I've said that yet today, but it is really nice to be back here. Thank you for coming out this evening. We're looking at Joshua 3. And if you're paying attention, way back in chapter 1, just a couple of weeks ago, in verse 2, we looked and God was saying, "Now therefore, go over this Jordan, you and all this people." That was in verse 2. Of chapter 1. We're already up to chapter 3 and we're still on the wrong side of the Jordan. A week later, we looked in, still in chapter 1, but down in verse 11, it says, "Pass through the camp, command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourself. Within 3 days, you will cross over this Jordan." And we're still waiting. We've known this is coming for a while. And we're still waiting. So if you ever know the song, it's time, did he just say it's time? We're still waiting a couple weeks later, right? You all do know VeggieTales, right? Yes, I think James explained that quite well. Good. Okay, so this isn't, though, the first time that the children of Israel have been at the border of the Promised Land. We've talked about Numbers 14. We've talked about the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea as the people of God hardened their hearts. We've talked about Numbers 32, where they've come up and it's this question of, but Reuben and Gad want to stay on the other side. They want to stay in the Transjordan. They want to stay on this side, if you want to put it in terms of how they're talking at that point. But we're at the point now where everyone's to cross over, including those from Reuben and Gad. And then we had some spies, and they've come back, and they've given a report, and it's actually a report of what God has done, a report of God's deliverance. It comes from the mouth of a prostitute, it comes from the mouth of a Canaanite, but it's a report of what God has done and is doing among these people. And then we come to chapter 3, and your question is chapter 3 exciting? Isn't that the question you're wondering? So, here's a quote from Trent Butler. He says, "No armies appear to contest the crossing. No Israelites rebel and want to retrace steps to Egypt. The raging river gains no new victims, and no foreign gods rise to contest Yahweh." Thank you for giving me Joshua chapter 3. Okay. Well, let's actually talk about this, okay? Now, most of, having gone through a couple weeks here, going through chapters 1 and 2, it's mostly been about preparation, getting ready to move in, and guess what? Most of this chapter is going to be about preparation. Most of this chapter, I don't know if you noticed as Phil read it, is speech, direct speech. It's mostly talking. So we're going to need to talk about the talking for 13 verses, okay? And then, once we get down to verses 14 to 17, then we can get to our second point, where we can actually talk about God's miracle, or God's wonder, as we talk about crossing the Jordan. But there is going to be a good bit of preparation before we get there, okay? So, in terms of preparation, verse 1, we've got Joshua and the Israelites, they come to the Jordan. I don't know if you've ever put yourself in Joshua's sandals. When he left Egypt, who had been leading? Moses. The children of Egypt, children of Israel get to Kadesh Barnea. You've got a massive rebellion, but who's the leader? Who are they rebelling against? Moses. Joshua is one of the faithful spies. I know ultimately they're rebelling against God, but you've got Moses as the leader, Moses leading. And then you get to this, I'm going to call it the Acacia Grove, okay? The Acacia Meadows Grove. Sort of where we are now, and Moses learns he is not going into the Promised Land. It's Joshua who is actually going to be leading them as they go into the Promised Land. And so Joshua is going to be leading, but without Moses. And that's very clear. Joshua rises early, and it doesn't say Joshua and Moses. It's Joshua who is stepping out in faith, who's leading at this point. And I don't know what went through his mind. I've touched on a couple things that have happened in terms of the past, even in terms of Moses, even some things that have happened there in that grove. It's in the Acacia Grove where we talk about the people beginning to commit harlotry with the women of Moab, back in Numbers 25. Numbers 26, we talk about a census. But now they're ready to move. And essentially, we've got about 7 miles to go until they come to the Jordan. And I know you've heard the passage, but even here in verse 1, you feel like you need a spoiler alert. They lodged there before they crossed over. They are going to cross over, spoiler alert, okay? But we are going to get there, but there's a little bit to come. Now, this crossing over, it won't surprise you. It's the main point of the passage, okay? It's going to occur 7 times as we go through, but that is a key part of our passage here. They are going to cross over. Verse 2. We get introduced to some officers. We already met them back in chapter 1, verse 10. And we're told about 3 days. 3 days gives you plenty of time to wander over and look at a river. I'm assuming that you've got men who've been wandering around in the wilderness for the last 40 years, talking about what good swimmers they are, based on their previous experience over the last 40 years. I'm assuming it was a little bit intimidating, to state the obvious. And they're thinking about their wife, their kids, family. And then, as I said, we get to some direct speech. And immediately we're introduced to the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord God. They're talking about crossing the river. You think they should be talking about military strategy, maybe a miracle, how to ford a river, maybe something about a sword. The point is God. Yes, they're crossing the river, but the point is God. And as we talk about a relationship with Him, even as we go through this passage, we're talking about trusting Him, stepping out in faith, and being obedient to Him. And the author will not let us forget God and who He is and what He's doing as we go through this passage. Now we know, back from Numbers, this is in Numbers 10, that the ark was going before the Israelites. Last time, when they were at the border of the Promised Land, what happened with the ark? Numbers chapter 14, verse 44. They presumed to go up to the mountaintop. Nevertheless, neither the ark of the covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. They were at the border, and the ark didn't move. But at this time, we're going to talk about the ark, and the ark is going to be moving. And as we talk about the ark, okay, I've talked about God, but there's a little bit in between. There's the covenant. David took us through just a couple weeks ago, through Genesis 12, through the Abrahamic covenant. He talked about a people, a place, protection, and a program. And what he said at that point is, those promises explain everything that happens in the rest of the Pentateuch. And I completely agree with him. We're not in the Pentateuch. We're in Joshua. And guess what? We're still talking about a place. With the Abrahamic covenant, it's vital for our understanding in terms of the Pentateuch, but it's also true in the rest of our Bible. Because that's really what's explaining what's going on in our passage here. We cannot ignore that God is the Lord of the whole earth. Who owns the land? He does. Can He give it to whom He chooses? Of course He can. He's sovereign. And who has He given it to? Israel. Is our God faithful? Are they going to get the land? That's what we see happening here. And so the officers command the people to follow, not too closely. It's around half a mile. And you're waiting at this point for some profound and theological explanation. At least I was. Okay, maybe you weren't. And then we're told, because you have not passed over in the way yesterday or the day before, which is a wonderful idiom, okay, meaning you haven't been this way before, which is quite obvious. They really haven't been this way because they've not been in the land, okay? So that is good theology, but it's essentially reasonably practical. And if you'll allow me to say this, we've got God's priest leading. I would call that GPL for short. And we're going to end up with God's priest standing. That would be GPS for short. And the whole point here is God is showing them the way to go. I see you're awake because you're smiling. This preparation throughout this passage, can I just quote Richard Hess, who says this? Christians are not called to carry out the same physical acts. I think that's very true, very obvious. But he says this, preparation is necessary for any life of ministry and service. As with Israel's preparation, it involves hearing and believing God's word and the discipline of obedience to that word. If I had a screen, I would put a photo of a certain college up there and talk about preparation. But I don't have one, so I won't mention that. But it's true. They had to be prepared, and yet it's based off of God and what he's doing. It goes back to a covenant. It goes back to what he's commanded them. And so they're obedient. They're faithful. We come to verse 5. And at this point, we're introduced to, well, we've got Joshua's commands. And he gives some commands to the people, verse 5, and then we'll talk about the priests in verse 6. And just as you're expecting to be told, okay, we're going to cross and then be ready with your swords for the other side. What we're told is we're going to cross, but actually before you cross, you need to be prepared. Because we've been talking about preparation, so now we need to talk about being prepared. Because God is going to work wonders. Now, don't miss this. We've got the role of God here. What God is doing, we've got the role of people, what they're asked to do. The people are not asked to work this wonder. They're not asked to work this miracle. But they are asked to prepare for that wonder, for that miracle. And they're asked to sanctify themselves, to consecrate themselves. We can talk about a previous generation that had been in Exodus who had seen God's wonders. Back in Exodus 3, God says he will stretch out his hand and strike Egypt with all of his wonders. And when we get to national failure, as we think of the golden calf incident, we can talk about Exodus 34. Where God says, behold, I make a covenant, Exodus 34, verse 10, he says, before all your people, I will do marvels, such as not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among you, among whom you are, all these other people shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. As a side note, all of these other people, I'm just going to call them unreached people groups, they are going to see what God is doing through these people. There is a challenge to missions there, in case you didn't get that, okay? I'll let you draw your own applications, though, okay? There's a table through there if you're struggling, okay? The verse right after that, so Exodus 34, verse 10, the verse right after that, verse 11, immediately, he says, God says he's going to drive all the people out of the land. We know from Rahab last week in Joshua 2, the inhabitants of Jericho had heard of these wonders. The Canaanites, these unreached people groups, they had heard. They'd heard what had happened with the Red Sea. They'd heard what had happened on the other side. And you get that amazing truth. where Rahab says, "The Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." People starting to hear. But at this point, there's going to be another wonder coming. God is going to do this wonder, and the people are to prepare themselves. They're to sanctify themselves. And so we come to the priests. And Joshua tells them, basically, you're going to carry this ark. You're going to go in front. Now, carrying the ark is a part of their job description. I'm fully aware of that. And going in front, that's been clear reasonably. But at this point, where are they going? They haven't been told what the wonder is. I'm not sure that they knew that it was in their job description to step into the Jordan. I don't know if they went back and had a conversation about it. Did they think, are we going wandering again? We've got to find a different way. I don't know. And that brings us to verse 7. Because at this point, Joshua has spoken to the priests. The priests are there with the ark. We already had the spoiler alert. They're going to cross over. You're getting ready for some action. And we get some more speech. Our author does not want us to miss the focus on God. And God speaks to Joshua. And Joshua is going to be exalted. And again, we already knew this from back in chapter 1, verse 5. And God is with Joshua. God is speaking to him. That is clear. But also God will be with Joshua. This is going to happen tomorrow. And that's God is, will be with him. That's going to be demonstrating in this crossing of the River Jordan. Is it Joshua that goes stepping into the water first? No. It's the priests that are going to be stepping in. So Joshua's leadership, Joshua's exaltation, does it have anything to do with his achievements? Not really. It's about God's achievements. It's about what God has done. And Joshua listens to God. He does do something. Don't miss that. He does do something. He listens to God. He believes God, and then he responds. Essentially, he's obedient. Now, in that, he had to listen to the Lord. And then after listening, he had to talk to the people. He had to tell them what to do. But essentially, he is obedient. He's obedient to the word of the Lord. And then the people, they also listen. They respond. They're obedient. And we know this had effect on Joshua, but also even on the people. When we get to the end of Joshua 24, it says, Joshua 24, verse 31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord. And I assume that that included the crossing of the Jordan. There's others in there, but I would assume that it includes that one. This had an effect on Israel. And we'll talk about remembering it, or at least you will, next week. Verse 8. Our priests come to the edge of the Jordan, and there they stand. They reach the edge, and they stand. And that's what they're supposed to do, because of the living God. And so in verse 9, we talk about God as the living God, who's the one who owns the land, and he's giving it to Israel. He's going to dispossess the Canaanites. I have a question. Is the physical important? I see a few heads nodding. If we're talking about the priest's feet stepping into the water, are we good that the water is physical and the feet are physical? Yeah. The ark that they're carrying is physical. There's an awful lot going on. But are we clear that stepping in with an ark into some water, there's something spiritual going on in terms of what it's showing, in terms of a trust in God, in terms of faith, in terms of what they're believing? And that's important as they go into the land. Is the land physical? Yeah? I mean, are we talking about the people of God here, the children of Israel? Yeah? Would it have fulfilled the Abrahamic covenant for them to have had the tabernacle and lived in the wilderness? That would have been a kind of interesting one. Is our God faithful? Yeah. So he does. He's made a physical promise. They're spiritual. Don't miss that. But he is going to fulfill his promise. And spiritually, as they go into the physical land, they need to be trusting God. And of course, they need to know that he's the living God. And so the people listen. We see that in verse 9. And there's something that they're to know. Something which they're to know that the living God is presently active. And Joshua is explaining, look, God lives. And he lives among us. And he's going to dispossess these other people groups. And that is emphatic at this point. And after we get the by this in verse 10, the by this you will know, we finally get to the this in verse 11. And the this is the crossing of the Jordan. It's probably what you're expecting it to be. No, it's actually what we talk about. It is the ark crossing. This is, by this, it's the ark crossing. Now, the ark crosses before the people, but that's how they know. And of course, as we've talked about, it's the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth. And if he's Lord of all the earth, he is also Lord of this river that's in front of them. And he's going to dispossess, and let's just talk about it very briefly here, the Canaanites. They're the ones that dwelt by the sea and over by the Jordan. Okay, the Hittites, they're the ones that were in the mountains. And when you think of Hittites, I assume you've got Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 3 in your mind. As I say to the students, smile and nod. Okay. God talking about Jerusalem says your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. So that's whenever I say Hittite, that's probably what you think of in terms of Jerusalem, right? Okay, never mind. Okay, Hivites, whenever I say the Hivites, you're thinking back to Shechem. Yes, Hamor, back at the time of Jacob, he was a Hivite. Okay, and the Hivites dwelt up by Mount Hermon. And then we will get back to the Hivites when we get to chapter 9, when we get to Gibeon, okay? Because we do need to talk about them. They're going to cause a few issues. The Perizzites, for the Perizzites, you go all the way back to Abraham. They've been in the Hivites we can talk about for a little bit. But the Perizzites, they were there all the way back at the time of Abraham. We know about them. And later, when we get to Joshua 17, Ephraim and Manasseh are going to come up and they're going to say, hey, we don't really like being here. We need big land. And of course, Joshua is from the tribe of Ephraim. And so in verse 15, he's going to say, well, go fight. And they're going to go, and he's going to say, look, go up to the forest country and the land of the Perizzites and the giants. There you go. Go up to the giants and the Perizzites, okay, in the forest country. So Perizzites, forest country. Girgashites, they're just mentioned in lists, so I'm going to keep going. Amorites, usually we talk about them on the other side of the Jordan, okay. And then Jebusites, we're good with Jerusalem, but you don't really deal with them until you get to 2 Samuel, okay. So those are the nations. Let's get back to some present action. Verse 12. James, when he was talking about Numbers 32, talked about Reuben and Gad wanting to stay on the Transjordan, what you and I might call the East Bank. But as Israel head to what we would call the Cisjordan or the West Bank, Joshua says they're to choose how many men? 12. How many tribes are going to inherit land on the one side? But they're to choose 12 men. Do we see some unity here? This is still one nation. And just to be clear, they don't know what they've been chosen for at this point. Okay? That's for another chapter. Okay? And what we're told in verse 13 is, again, we're told a when. It's as soon as the rest of the priest's feet, okay? So as soon as the priest's feet come to rest, that then the waters of the Jordan will be cut off. An awful lot of preparation, an awful lot of reminders about God, about what he's been doing since back in the Pentateuch, bringing us to this point. And so now we can begin to talk about a miracle and a wonder. Now there's a miracle here, which is that the water stops. There's also something else which happens, which is there is a crossing which the people do. Okay, the miracle wouldn't be much good if the people didn't walk across. And the people wouldn't be walking across if the miracle didn't happen for the water to stop. Okay? I assume that the children of Israel got up that morning, had breakfast. It says in my notes that some of them used manna for breakfast, 1,001 favorite recipes. It's apparently hard to get a copy of these days, but apparently they were quite popular back those. I don't know what their favorite recipe was, but what we were told is that the people of Israel were to break camp as soon as the priests, as soon as they saw the priests. So they break camp and were told the priests are going ahead. I'd like to point out that it's been a little bit snowy today, a little bit of sleet. There was some rain. It was actually quite sunny this morning. Doesn't that build the suspense in the sermon? Weren't you impressed by that? Some of you are not quite sure what to do with that. Doesn't something sometimes, you're waiting for the action and then suddenly there's something thrown in and you're like, and it just builds the suspense. Isn't that great storytelling? Great. I mean, that's what we see here in verse 15. We get a seasonal update. Just what you're expecting. The Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest. Yeah, just what you wanted, a seasonal weather report. I mean, it is somewhat helpful, and the harvest you'll come back to, okay, in a couple chapters. That bit is important. Don't forget that. But what we've got is a big river, and then we can finally get to, okay, talking about what I've called how touching. Okay, this is the bit where if you're touchy-feely, this is where the feet start touching. Okay, God had promised, they believed, they're obedient to God. And when crossing the Jordan, this wonder doesn't start until the priests who are carrying the ark actually step into the Jordan. Okay? It's not when the rest of Israel do something. It's not when Joshua does something. Okay? Now, obviously, it is possible to get across when it is overflowing its banks, but it's usually only a few people that manage it at that point. For that, your cross-reference is 1 Chronicles 12:15. During the time of David, the people of Gad managed to get over and join his army, but they're considered quite brave for doing so. Verse 16. The waters stop. The waters are still. It actually says in my notes here that, which I wrote, so of course they do. It says, I wonder if Joshua thought of writing a psalm at this point, all about how God leads me by the still waters. In reference to the Jordan, because they stop flowing. They're still and you can't see them. I don't know. Maybe he thought he'd leave that for somebody else because he wasn't sure his psalm would make it into the top 150 chart. But at this point, we have God leading. We have some still waters. We're talking about 18 miles north, okay, up by the river Jabbok. And if you're paying attention to your verbs, we're in verse 16, but if you look back at verse 14, it talks about when the people, and it talks about the priests bearing. You get to verse 15, and we talk about bearing the ark again. We get the feet dipping. And then it's only finally in verse 16 that we get to the water, which stood still, which rose in a heap, which failed, and were cut off. Isn't that great? But don't miss the end of the verse. Okay, because there's two parts to this verse. We already talked about it. What God does, the water, and don't miss the end of the verse, the people crossed over. Because that's also kind of important. Okay? They really did cross over. So, verse 17. We're told at this point that the water has stopped, dried up, and at this point we find out that the priests are now stood in the middle of the Jordan. But as much as we're talking about the Jordan, as exciting as all of that is, our passage will not let us forget the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. We're continuously reminded of God's presence. We're also told that all the people, this nation, cross over We have to, as we talk about not just a place, as we talk about a people, we have to talk about a nation, a people of God. And at this point, we've got the people of God entering the place which God had promised them. They are obedient and they are entering in obedience. Let me read you a quote from Trent Butler. He says this: "No armies appear to contest the crossing. No Israelites rebel and want to retrace steps to Egypt. The raging rivers gain no new victims, and no foreign god rises to contest Yahweh. The narrative presents a unified people in a unified plan to achieve a unified goal with no opposition." Sometimes that is a part of what God is doing. So, where does this get us? Well, the people are now on the West Bank, but not by very far. We need to get into chapter 4. You maybe have some questions. God has been providing manna for the last 40 years. Is that going to continue? That's a great question. What do we do with the manna recipe books? God has given them victory in the wilderness. It's a little bit different when you come up against a fortified city. That's going to look a little bit different. They've had a whole lot of preparation. But in some ways, even the preparation has been preparing for them for this, crossing the Jordan, but even that is preparation for what's coming next, right? And there's still more preparation before we get to chapter 6. Still another two chapters of preparation. And even then, we can talk about Jericho, Ai, Gibeon, and then we've got to attack the southern softies and then the hard northern people. But the unknown future is not the most important question. The question is, this is the people of God, and God is the focus of the passage. And it's about our relationship with God. And in talking about crossing the Jordan, that God is the focus is obviously very clear, particularly as we move into chapter 5. So, a couple points from this passage. I think we can see that we should be strong and courageous. Joshua is, so are the priests, so are the people. In that sense, it's getting tougher, and it will get tougher. They're going to face the city, they're going to face some sin within their own people, they're going to face failure, even amongst their leaders. But they're to be strong and courageous. Of course, we know that from chapter 1. They are to be obedient. And we see that as we've gone through. Joshua is very careful to obey God. When God speaks, then Joshua obeys. He talks to the officers. He talks to the people. The Israelites obey. We talk about the 12 men getting chosen. We talk about the priest carrying the ark. We talk about them crossing. They are obedient. There's that constant relationship of God being worked out as they respond. And of course, we've seen the living God is with them. They are not to be terrified, even as they think about all the ites in where they're headed. But God is with us. When the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, they were running away from danger. If I can put it this way, there was some safety in the wilderness. There was a lot of other problems. But in many ways, it was easy to be running away from Egypt and headed to a wilderness. They're now leaving the wilderness, and they're headed into the promised land, into a place of rest. And this place of rest is going to involve a chance to live and grow as they move towards danger. And as they move into this promised land of rest, they are moving towards danger. They are moving towards conflict. Maybe that's why this preparation was so important. What we see is God is at work with his people in a place. This is a part of his program. And he is at work. Does this involve the physical? At this point, could I ask, does our work maybe involve a building? That would be the easy one to pick on. Is a building useful? Yeah. Kind of glad on a rainy night. Is the spiritual important? Absolutely. Is it sometimes easy for us to get so focused on the spiritual we forget the physical? Even when we read our Bibles? Is it sometimes easy to get so focused on the physical we forget the spiritual? We have a living God who is at work. We respond in faith and obedience to him. Let's pray.